From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
This is something that's very special for our manufacturers and for our farmers from both countries, for all of the people that work for jobs.
That was President Donald Trump on Monday announcing that a new deal had been forged between the U.S. and Mexico inside the parameters of NAFTA.
It's also great trade, and it makes it a much more fair bill.
After the announcement, Richard Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, was asked by an NPR reporter if he thought that the revisions that had been obtained by the Trump administration were going to help his membership.
From what we've heard, I do. The current version of NAFTA has harmed small farmers, ranchers, businesses, and working people across North America. And the only clear winners so far have been global corporations. This is trying to reverse that in many areas. Look, if we give Mexican workers higher wages, they're going to be able to buy more products. If they can buy more products, that increases demand for not only Mexican-made products, but U.S. and Canadian-made products. When their wages rise, all of us begin to win.
For more on that, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero from Philadelphia via Skype on Thursday. Well, you heard it. What do you think?
Yes, and it's very important what Trumka said, because what he's saying is that the only way to get beyond the economic recession of 2008-2009, which is still with us if you're a worker or if you're a poor person, and certainly if you're a black or woman or Mexican or Puerto Rican worker, you're still living the Great Recession. And what Trumka is saying is two things. One, that the only way to finally get beyond that is to put more money in the pockets of workers in the United States, in Mexico, and in Canada. And he was addressing that provision, and we don't know the whole deal with Mexico. We only know its basic architecture. But this idea that any worker in an auto plant owned by the United States must be paid at least $16 an hour, and that includes Mexican workers. So this idea that Mexican workers will be paid $5 or $10 an hour and American workers close to $30 an hour, which then makes it profitable for auto corporations to go to Mexico rather than to stay in Michigan or Wisconsin or anywhere else. So that's important. The other thing that I think Trumka is saying is that these multilateral trade deals like NAFTA, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, have impoverished workers in the United States and throughout the world. And he agrees that in terms of trade agreements, we must go from the multilateral, these supranational agreements, to bilateral trade agreements where the interest of each nation, and from the standpoint of Trumka, the working people of each nation must be considered in any negotiations. So he's supporting this kind of bilateral trade agreement. And he's also saying implicit in that is the move back from this neoliberal globalization. Now, of course, finally, Trumka is taking a big risk because by the labor movement, which, by the way, most of the big industrial unions, including the Teamsters and the UAW and the United Steelworkers and the International Association of Machinists and the AFL-CIO, met 2 Mondays ago at the White House with Trump concerning the NAFTA agreement.
Right.
But what Trumka knows he is doing is that this could be the nail in the coffin of the attempt of the Democrats to take the House of Representatives back. Certainly, the labor movement will not be out there stumping for Democrats who oppose this new tweaking or revising of NAFTA. They're not going to do that. They will support Democrats or Republicans who support the labor movement's position on trade. So what Trumpka said and what Trump did in this renegotiation will have large impact politically on the midterm elections.
Yeah, for sure. It was remarkable to me just to hear the head of the AFL-CIO.
Oh, yeah.
And particularly, I mean, Trumpka actually is, you know, out of the group of people that have come to the leadership of American labor unions over the last decades, he's about as left as they've come.
Yeah.
And for him to be looking at this in those terms, in other words, outside the parameters of what would be the best thing for me to say to get Democrats elected, and rather say what's going to be the best thing for the members of my union.
Absolutely.
That's kind of remarkable. And the backdrop, it's interesting because that was that conversation took place on Wednesday. And on Tuesday or Monday, I forget which, the Urban Institute released a study. It was published on the 28th by them, I think. And it showed, in terms of the landscape, I mean, you talk about coming back from 2008, you know, the conditions that people are living through, that not everybody has recovered. As a matter of fact, some 40% of households mm-hmm. have some experience with one or another necessity of life having to be skipped over in the past year. For
right.
example,
absolutely.
40% had to skip a meal. You know, on a regular basis. 10% mm-hmm. skipped a mortgage payment or rent. Mm-hmm. And in between, 24% had hardships with medical care where they didn't take, 18% of respondents didn't pay medical bills because they didn't have money. 17.8% didn't get medical care they needed because they didn't have money. 13% missed utility bill payments. In other words, a sizable part are having trouble just, you know, coping with day-to-day life.
Yeah, and see, here is where Donald Trump's political rhetoric and political strategy goes up against the real life realities of people that voted for him. You see, he's touting that the economy is growing and the stock market is breaking records and so on, but 40% of the U.S. population, which we're talking about, the majority of working people in this country, are still in a deep economic crisis, where they're not eating, where they're not paying their mortgage, where they're not paying their insurance, where their car note is not being paid, and so on. So he is not addressing the fundamental life conditions of the people that voted for him as an insurgency, as a statement to the economic and political elites. So on the one side, the NAFTA agreement is very good for a part of the working class, but it will take years, even with that agreement, for people in the auto and steel industries to recover. And that does not even speak to the larger number of workers who are in service, in hotel, in government jobs, not to mention adjunct and non-tenured professors at
right.
big universities
right.
who often are homeless and living in their cars and are not eating. And so I say all of that to say that the crisis that made Trump the president, the political and economic crisis, continues.
That's right.
And I think that he has done very little to speak in substantive terms to the crisis of everyday living of the vast majority of working people.
Well, again, the same study, for example, is that provides a roadmap to the solution to that problem if he's interested.
Right.
Because it says here, for example, adults under the age of 35 were 8.6% more likely to report financial hardship. Mm-hmm. Women, black folks, Hispanic folks, single adults more likely to struggle to make ends meet. So if you're going to try to, you know, produce some material benefits to people of your administration that mm-hmm. in turn will have, you know, translate into political support, it seems that that would be a good way to target it. Would be
who's
feeling it worse,
you
right?
See, yeah. he just can't keep saying black and Latino unemployment are at historic lows.
Right.
That might be true. But the big question is labor force participation.
Right. As well.
And the next question is this flatlining of wages over the last 30 years.
Right.
And you know, in other words, I say that to say that the political crisis of 2016 that produced these insurgency movements in both parties, Bernie Sanders and Trump, that crisis continues and has perhaps deepened. And I think in a real sense, the political environment is more uncertain today than it was in 2016. And for example, if you take the Democratic primary in Florida, where Andrew Gillum, this black mayor of Tallahassee, wins over a establishment Democrat who was supposed to win.
Right.
And that only happens because the party is in a state of crisis,
right,
of really breakup, of division. And I think that is the case with the Republican Party.
Yep.
Although, and I would not, and I caution against making the mistake of saying what the elected officials in the House and the Senate say, what those Republicans say, they're with Trump on X, Y, and Z. I would not take that as an indicator of what's really going on in the base. I would not even take the polling data that 40% or 89% of the Republicans are still with him. I wouldn't take that as an indication of the unstableness within the Republican Party, especially at its base.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can't assume stability regardless of, first of all,
yes,
you can't rely on polls for very much, at least,
yes,
unless you're going to dig deep into them and look at what they act, you know, the actual structure of the study.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
mm-hmm,
you know, we saw that when we actually did that during the election, we saw that no one was asking about the essential questions that had been identified in it, which had to do with people having jobs and, you know, income insecurity and, you know, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
People weren't being asked that. They were being asked all the cartoon stuff that had to do with the TV narrative, as opposed to the stuff that related,
right,
to their own lives. And so,
right,
those polls predictably did not predict anything.
But, yes, absolutely.
But you know, that aside from, you know, not relying on polls, you cannot assume stability in any of the structures at present, given the condition of the entire system of structures.
Right, right. You know, Lenin referred to a crisis like this as a general crisis,
right,
of the system. And I think, maybe not saying anything different, I would use the word a total crisis. A total crisis. It affects every area of the life of the society and all of its institutions, major institutions, minor institutions. You know, just one indicator is very important: the decline in print newspapers and the fact that people are not buying them, people are not subscribing to them, and the decline in the viewership of all of the news channels and general stations, be it the cable news networks, MSNBC, CNN, Fox, or be it NBC, CBS, and ABC. People are not paying attention. People have retreated from all of the fundamental institutions of the society, which produces a crisis of legitimacy. And it is total, I would say, in a lot of senses, irreversible, and that people are saying that they reject the system, especially young people, saying they prefer socialism. And that's another problem
right.
for the Republicans, for the Republican Party. They want to run against socialism, and that's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, if not in 2018, in 2020, because people, even if it's a third party that can't win, it could be a third party that will decide who will win.
That's right.
You know, and if that party runs on a socialist platform, something like Eugene Debs in 1912, ran as a socialist and as a labor activist. Something similar to that could be the deciding force in a three-way national race.
Absolutely.
You know, and who knows what's going to happen at the conventions of both of the parties. Certainly, people are talking about the 50th anniversary of the 1968 Democratic Party convention in
right.
August 1968.
Right.
Well, we might be looking at something similar in 2020 in the Democratic Party, and maybe in the Republican Party. So this is a very unstable political moment. The people want answers. They don't want slogans. They don't want charismatic leaders.
Right,
they
right.
want real solutions to their problems.
They want to eat and live
yes.
indoors and have health care and be able to educate their kids and not mm-hmm. like stress all the time over that and feel that they were in a precarious situation with respect to those things.
And you know, the other thing, and this is probably a strong hand for Donald Trump, they want peace.
Yeah. Well, you can't have these others.
Without peace, yeah. That's right.
And, you know, one of the things that I've been watching the political, it's almost sacrilege to refer to what goes on in the United States, you know, this electoral circus as politics, because it's
yes.
you know, politics is supposed to be the place where public policy is made, the mechanism by which public policy is, consensus for public policy is produced, and that it's set in motion to be actualized, and that isn't what happens here at all. That stuff is decided a priori. And the rest is just circus that's supposed to keep
yes.
people entertained while the people who have decided what public policy is going to be go out actualizing it, you know, behind closed doors or wherever. And in our laps,
yeah.
in our faces, too, because
yeah.
part of their public policy is to, you know, further impoverish us and cart off whatever we might have silverware laying in the kitchen or whatever. And that they do right in front of us. So it's not all secret. But watching the the electoral game develop for around 2018, we had Bannon that was going to be a third, fourth, or fifth force, whatever. He was going to
mm-hmm.
go out and organize opposition to the establishment Republicans. We've seen you talk about socialism. You know, we started seeing when Obama was first running. The phenomenon that the Republicans tried to call him, and the Democrats, some of them, tried to call him a communist or a socialist, and every
mm-hmm.
time they did, he went up in the polls.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen, sort of the, with Sanders particularly, the readmission of the term socialist into political dialogue here.
Mm-hmm.
And the
mm-hmm.
Republicans looking at that like, oh boy, because we can beat up on commies and pinkos, but
mm-hmm.
the best thwarting of that the Democrats have been able to come up with is by not actually producing a real socialist. Every time
mm-hmm.
they come up with one, they turn around and show, how horrible. You know, Bernie Sanders, the socialist, talking about Hugo Chavez, the dead communist dictator, one of the worst war hawks out there. This one that won the primary here in New York, whose name escapes me at the moment, the young woman from Yorktown.
Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah, okay. She couldn't gush about John McCain, the war criminal, enough mm-hmm. in a tweet mm-hmm. the other day. And I'm saying mm-hmm. to myself, if you're farming for a constituency comprised of socialists, why are you fishing with that bait?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, what I'm thinking is that a party of the people, a fusion of socialists and those who have not made up their minds about socialism, but who want a decent life across the board, rooted in the grassroots, such a party is what is on the agenda right now. And that's what the election of Ocasio-Cortez, of Gillum in Florida, and some others around the country suggest. Now, the mistake, I think, that the Democratic Socialists of America make is that they're going into the Democratic Party in order to transform it and take it back rather than to build outside of the Democratic Party among those forces, especially young people, who are for socialism right. and who despise the Democratic Party and, in fact, distrust and Ocasio-Cortez because, one, she's in the Democratic Party, and secondly, because of her statement vis-a-vis John McCain, which then puts her in the war party yeah. wing right. of the Democratic Party.
That's right.
And so, you know, the insurgents that brought us Bernie Sanders in 2016 are not going to follow them into the Democratic Party, especially yeah. since the people who run it and control it are the same people responsible for stealing the election from Bernie Sanders.
You know, so, on top of mm-hmm. that, just to interrupt 1 second, because yes, you yes. invoked before, you know, the image of the socialist presidential candidate in you know, Eugene Debs in what year was it?
1912.
And he ran again in 1916. And when he mm-hmm. ran for president in 1916, he did it from in a prison. And the reason he was in prison was because he said, as a socialist, I am against all wars because they damage the working class. They're fought right. by the working class, against the working class, for the property classes, and I'm mm-hmm. therefore against them. Mm-hmm. So these guys that are calling themselves socialists 100 years later and that are favoring imperialist wars are obviously not socialists.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting that you bring that up. And sometimes how little we learn from history. You know, W.E.B. Du Bois, who became one of the great figures fighting for mm. peace and was indicted by the American government because of that,
yep.
Said that the greatest mistake he ever made was to support Wilson's going into World War One. And now he had his reasons. He thought that it would rebound to civil rights at home. He felt, and he fought for there to be black officers over black troops, and that black troops not only do kitchen work and latrine work, but they be armed and in fighting units. And he also thought that German imperialism posed a greater threat to the enlargement of colonialism in Africa and Asia. But that's a whole nother question.
Yeah.
But he said that was his greatest mistake.
Right.
Now, he supported Franklin Roosevelt in World War II and supported the Soviet Union. But right. he became, in the Cold War, this huge anti-war figure. Now, what have we learned, we socialists, and I put quotes around that, from history? And it seems to me very little, because by going into the Democratic Party, I think the DSA is frankly saying we're prepared to be the shock forces on the ground to elect Democrats and to prepare the ground for a Warren or whoever the Democratic Party candidate is in 2020. And we're prepared to compromise on the question of war and peace. And I think that's a compromise we cannot afford to make.
Yeah. if you're looking at this from a class perspective, which if you're concerned about working people is, you know, a given, well, you have to look at the world in that context. And the workers of the world are not the middle class voters in Westchester County, New York, but rather the people who are getting bombed by the imperialist shock troops around the world. They're the people whose blood is being sucked to finance this planet, the people who are working in mines at gunpoint and carrying the goods to ships offshore, the people whose agricultural products are being stolen from them and their labor, and the people that are forced to sit and starve in their own countries because all of the things of value have been taken out or are in the process of being taken out. That's the working class. If you're if you want to look out for workers, those are your allies, because if you don't protect them, that's your job next.
Well, you see, and here is the logic of the socialists in the Democratic Party compromising with the corporate Democrats. The logic of why they become a part of the war regime is that they agree with the elite on this Russiagate fraud. They agree. Right. Bernie Sanders, Ocasio, Cortez, and most of agree on the Russiagate thing. And everyone that knows anything knows it's a ruse. It's a political ploy to delegitimize the 2016 election and to get Trump out. It's a part of a moving coup d'etat, which is now failing, I think. Right. But once you go there, then, you know, it opens the door to everything, because then you have Russia as the enemy and so on. A lot of people say, well, do you support Putin? The question is not whether we support Putin. The question is, do we support peace and detente and denuclearization of Europe and the relations between the United States and Russia? That is the question. Right. The question of Putin, what happens with him, is the problem for the Russian people, not for us.
That's right. Now, when we have solved our own problems,
yes, then maybe we can advise them. Like him or not, we talked about it last week, the article in the Washington Times. Now, of course, I don't think many people, even after hearing our discussion of it and so on, have read that article or paid it much attention. That is one of the most important articles, and it explains a number of things, including Trump's distancing himself, if not his entire administration, from NATO.
Right.
And his saying after his meeting with Kim, or before his meeting with Kim Jong-un, or after, that the war games on the Korean Peninsula were dangerous war provocations.
Yeah.
Or his going against what Mattis said in terms of the other day, that we are going to resume military exercises with Japan and South Korea in the waters off of North Korea. And Trump said, no, we will not.
No, we're not.
Now,
yep.
These are gestures. But in the fog of this internal political war, the truth and clarity become the first victims.
Right.
So rather than the peace movement seizing upon that, trying to hold this guy to what he says, the peace movement is silent about these things.
I know.
And these are very important events. Now, thankfully, the labor movement, which deals with the life of its membership, and its membership, their members are not doing that well, could not afford to be absent from the discussion of revising NAFTA.
That's
now, whether it will solve all of the problems of the industrial workforce, I know it will not.
Right.
But it is relief on the way to resolving the deeper, more consequential problems of the entire working class.
Right, we got to stop there. Tony, thank you so much, and we'll speak
thank
with you again next week.
Appreciate it, Don. Take care.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.